Island, baby, wasn't this boy? Baby, wasn't this boy? Well, then I don't want to never hurt your feelings or either get mad.
Wakey, wakey.
Time for an unbalanced breakfast with Matt and Catherine, a.k.a. Smart.
Hamburger, the cornerstone of any nutritious breakfast.
My boy says he can eat 50 eggs, he can eat 50 eggs.
Do you like apples?
I don't drink juice.
How about you, Sadburns? You want some of this milk?
Bless his highly nutritious microwave my macaroni and cheese dinner that people sold it on sale. Amen.
They've got the hottest takes on the hottest stories and trends in food, nutrition, and fitness.
Come on! Bread makes you fat.
Bread makes you fat?
I haven't had a carb since 2004.
Calories, that's a gluten. Fat, that's a gluten.
Yeah, it's got electrolytes.
So protein combined with synthetic aminos, vitamins, and minerals. Everything the body needs.
I'm only eating foods with less than 30% calories from fat. It's 40%.
He read the squirrels were high in cholesterol.
We're about to find out what happens when a policy student and a science student interact.
And I also brought you some hydroponically grown goji berries with vegan barbecue sauce and some organic pumpkin chips.
Short answer, being vegan just makes you better than most people.
I happen to be a vegetarian.
You must have had vegetables fresher than that growing up on a farm, Greg.
Never trust a vegetarian.
Looks like meat's back on our menu.
The views and opinions expressed on this show are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of WMFO, Tufts University, or the Friedman School of Nutrition.
Yes. Who's hungry?
And the people did feast upon the lambs and sloths and carp and anchovies and orangutans and breakfast cereals and fruit bats.
Good morning and welcome to An Unbalanced Breakfast on WMFO in Medford 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org. Hello, Catherine, how are you?
Hello, I'm hanging in. How are you? You had a crazier night than me.
Yeah, you may be able to hear it already. But So yeah, I'm not sure how hot my nutrition takes will be today, but we're going to power through.
Yeah, he was at a concert in a mosh pit all night. I had an equally crazy night because for everyone who doesn't know, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt season 2 came out yesterday. So it's clearly everybody already knows it's a national holiday.
Obviously.
Basically. So it's like I'm being repetitive bringing it up, but if you haven't started yet, it's pretty good.
I have never started that show ever.
Oh my gosh, it's great.
But yeah, so I was out in Worcester at the New England Metal and Hardcore Festival night one. A lot of great bands. But sometimes you pay for it in the pit and in other ways too. So
yeah.
But we'll move right along. So the thing is, this morning we are guestless for the first time since week one. So we'd announced that Ashley Colpart from the Food Corridor would be joining us. That's going to be postponed, I think, by a week. So hopefully she will be on next week. So you are stuck with the two of us for the morning.
But luckily we've collected all of the food stories for the week, so there'll be plenty to chat about, and there'll be, you know, as usual, tasteful musical selections.
Yes. So. And if you'd like to join in, the number here is 617-627-3800. You can also chime in on Twitter at Nutrition Wonk and at Boxman37.
Yeah. And please call us because we want to chat.
Yeah, we love talking to you all. So, and obviously, it's not a national holiday coming up, but on Monday, it's at least a local holiday. It is Patriots Day, and it is the Boston Marathon.
Marathon Monday. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. You work in a bookstore, but I used to work at a Athleta. So, I used to work at a women's athleisure wear store, similar to a Lululemon. And I worked on Newbury Street, which was right by where kind of the marathon finish line was. So, this weekend was like it was like holiday. If you ever worked in retail, holiday is crazy.
It's like your Black Friday.
It was like our Black Friday, and it was amazing because it was the only single weekend in the year where we would sell out of every single extra, extra small. Because all of these women would come in who were just serious runners, and they would like buy out everything we had in the teeniest, tiniest sizes. It was funny.
But you're no longer there?
No, I don't work there now, but it's a great, I loved working there. It was a great store. But it was a fun weekend, kind of to have all the runners come in. We do marathon events.
That's cool. That is cool. And are you going to be heading in on Monday?
I will. I'm going to be seeing my counterpart, Carl Pett. He'll be running.
Awesome.
So, yeah.
And this is not his first time, right?
No, I'm embarrassed because I don't know if it's his third or fourth time running Boston, but he's been running it for a while, so it's fun, and I get to see it from different parts of the course, which is good.
Very cool. And so we wanted to connect that to some nutrition as well today.
Mm-hmm.
So is there anything you wanted to kick off with in terms of runners and their nutrition? Any questions?
You know, you're much more of a runner than I am. I did notice, though, that if I ran long distances, actually not that long, anything over, I would say, 6 miles, I would get a really sensitive stomach, and I wound up having to choose what I ate, like, really carefully if I was going on a long run. So I would have, I remember being like, one and a half to 2 hours before I would go for a run, I would have like one or one and a half cups of coffee, one banana, and one egg. And that could be what I ate.
How long before you ran?
Like an hour, an hour and a half, okay. Maybe. So that everything was like out of my system by the time I went for my run. And then I would like really eat once I was done.
Mm-hmm. That is kind of the biggest question that most runners have, is what to eat before I run, what to eat after I run. But the before the run thing is a much more complicated issue. And mm-hmm. much like everything else in nutrition, there's not one good answer for you. Like you said, you only need an hour to eat and be ready to go on a long run. I need much longer than that.
You do?
Yes.
How long?
At least 2 to 3 hours.
Oh, really?
So
wow.
So if I'm running even if it's a 5K or a marathon at 9 o'clock, then I'm up at 6 o'clock eating and getting ready, because it's a very long, involved process. We had we were talking about the show yesterday at Friedman, and a bystander suggested we talk about a certain bodily function and how it relates to running. And that's your biggest issue before you run. Like you have to deal with your stomach.
You want to make sure you don't have to go number two,
mm-hmm.
right? That's the main key.
Especially in a race,
yeah. And I mean, I've only run a few races. You probably run a lot more than me. But I feel like I always have to not go number two, luckily. But I always have to go to the bathroom at some point, and you can tell that like a lot of people have not planned this
mm-hmm.
well enough. As soon as you walk into one of those porta potties, it's gross.
That's a whole other issue. There was on the marathon I did last year. I think we kicked off the race, and within the first, it might have been the half that I did, but within the first mile, one of the leaders went running right over to the porta potty. So yeah, you can talk about, maybe somebody's having a bad day, it could be poor planning. But yeah, there's a ton of stuff on the internet. You talked about, I work at a bookstore, there's a ton of books out there.
Mm-hmm.
And we also talked about this when Chrissy was on.
I was just about to say that, yeah.
Yeah, so, well, go ahead then.
Well, yeah, no, snacking and sneakers.
Yep.
So Chrissy Carroll's blog, she was a guest on our show. She has a bunch of tips for how to start running long distances, and then I'm looking at tips for running a half marathon. And so this is a little bit more simple. So she had like, be prepared, take recovery seriously, that type of thing. But did you find any snacking advice?
Well, it's what I kind of liked her. I can't remember some of her specifics now, but I thought hers was pretty good. But because a lot of times it's like people say the same thing. I don't know. It's one of those things when you look up any nutrition advice, it's kind of a lot of the websites attempt to do a one size fits all thing, and it doesn't work. And,
right.
Like some people say oatmeal, some people say no,
right.
Just have a banana. Some people need a lot of food. Like if I'm running a marathon, it'd be like at least 2 bagels before I run.
Oh,
and then
really?
Other people are like, can't run after eating at all.
Right.
So yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, some people do the like traditional pasta dinner thing the night before. Some
that,
people don't.
Yeah, that I am a proponent of.
You are?
Yes.
Yeah.
I had to hunt down. So when I ran Philly last year, we were going to eat at the hotel and had borderline fancy foods. But it was fine for me because, you know, there was pasta, there's chicken, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So because that's before a marathon. But I had some family come down and watch. And one of my family members, I won't specify who, was not feeling this restaurant. And somehow she got priority of where to choose to eat, even though I was running or the race the next morning.
Oh, my goodness.
And so we wound up at a Hard Rock Cafe.
Oh, my gosh.
Which is not, even though it's, you know, good for teenagers and what they want to eat, it's not the most runner-friendly option. So I had to get a custom order of pasta dish at Hard Rock Cafe.
That is so funny. You were like the guy in the chef in the back. Is like, who is this guy?
I mean, I think it amounted to I wanted like the macaroni and cheese and chicken without cheese.
They're probably so used to it, though, because they probably have so many kids coming in that it's like, I want pasta with butter. Yeah.
And I mean, in that weekend,
they
too.
They probably like, thought you were like a six-year-old. Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, Hard Rock Cafe, man, that's the place to go if you're like a 13-year-old having a birthday party.
Yeah, right.
I mean, or other times. There are lots of times to go to a Hard Rock Cafe. That's so funny that you went to a Hard Rock Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's interesting because I feel like there's a lot of debate like on the internet and just in the running world in general. Like, if you're running distances, should you be eating actual foods, or should you be consuming like goos or packets or gels? And I mean, I think when you consult experts, usually they wind up saying, well, you know, do what works best for you based on your experience. I don't know if you ever read that book, Born to Run.
Yes.
I was going to say, it's kind of like a hilarious thing to ask people now, like, oh, have you read Born to Run? But
it took me, I didn't read until last year.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But I was just thinking about Scott Jurek, who's like an ultra marathoner, runs like, you know, 150 miles in a single race or something. He is a vegan and he'll eat like bean burritos. And you're just like, I cannot imagine like running 100 miles and eating a bean, like stopping eating a bean burrito.
Yeah.
Running more, you're like, whoa, talk about stomach problems,
right? And and that's a whole other breed of people. So let's see, we're gonna do our first ever attempt. Let's do our first ever attempt at a live call here.
Uh-oh.
This could be exciting.
Yeah.
So let me see. WMFO, hello.
Hey, I wanted to call into Matthew's and Catherine's show.
Yes. Hello. Is this Ashish?
Yes.
Hey, you are live on the air.
You're on the radio.
Oh, great.
So,
how are you guys?
Good.
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well myself. I just woke up and
we can tell.
Yeah.
So what's up? What made you want to call in today?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I was listening to you guys about like talking about running and diets for running.
Yeah.
But what I wanted to ask is, like, how do I avoid, like, injuries while running? Because last Saturday, I decided that I wanted to, say, like, get back into running and all that stuff. But I ran, I guess, like, 3 or 4 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day, I had, like, trouble with my, like, metatarsal. And I couldn't run, like, till now, like, it has not been, like, well. So I think I have a slight swelling in my leg. So I don't know, like every time I want to like do something, like say running or something, then I injure myself. So I really want to know, like, what do you guys think about?
Well, swelling might be a legit injury, but so did you just kind of, you hadn't been running for a while and you just went out and ran 3 or 4 miles?
Yeah, pretty much. Like, I do walk a lot, but nothing like jogging or running.
Hmm.
I would say, actually, Ashish, I'm just going to take you off the air for now, so we'll talk about this now. So thank you very much for the call. And so, yeah, I think I would say specifically with running is, and again, we're not medical doctors, we're not physical therapists or coaches or anything, but in my experience, you really just need to start slow.
Right.
And if you I mean, I had run for several years, had an injury that was unrelated, so I wasn't really doing much at all for, I don't know, 6-9 months. And when I was able to run again, I didn't just hop back onto my regular schedule and start going. I went back to kind of square one, and you just have to, and especially if, like, runners are known for being stubborn, and you don't want to rest and you don't want to stop, and
right.
You just want to get right back out there. But you really just need to start slow. You don't necessarily need to do like a couch to 5K type thing where you're alternating walking and running. Maybe if you have zero experience, that would be good. But I mean, if you are athletic or whatever, you know, go out, just run 1 mile one day.
Right,
take a day off, then run 2 miles and see how that feels. In terms of, you know, more specific injuries and swelling, stuff like that, that could be a larger problem if that is
Yeah. I was going to say, don't ask me because I've had an injured ankle. Right,
You've actually experienced this a lot more recently.
Yeah, I did. Ashish, I went running and, you know, this is a humiliating story, so I don't know why I'm like, now I'll tell it. But I went for a run and I actually didn't even, it wasn't even that I injured myself running. I was logging my run in my run tracker as soon as I was done, and I tripped and I injured my ankle. It's so humiliating because it's like the number one rule of like walking is like don't stop paying attention to where you're going.
Yeah.
And so it was funny because I actually texted Matt because I was like, I think maybe I really injured my ankle. But I think the first rule as she is make sure your eyes are open and stuff. But I mean, even with this, it's like I definitely didn't do a good enough job of immediately working on, okay, resting, compression, like not putting too much weight on it for a while. I did not do a good enough job of that, and it makes the recovery take a lot longer. Mm-hmm. So I think like respecting the fact that like you're not feeling so hot and not pushing yourself is key.
Yep. Yeah. So yeah, start slower. And then yeah, definitely recover to the whole RICE acronym.
Mm-hmm.
Rest, icing, compression and elevation.
Yes.
Icing definitely goes a long way.
Right.
So yeah, that'd be my big thing is just cut way back on the mileage, and I would say for at least 2 weeks before you do anything serious. And
right.
One thing I found too is, again, this is just like nutrition in terms of like, what should I eat before I run? There's so many different schedules out there, but if you find one that works, it's going to be really helpful to find something online that will give you... Well, I always tell people to pick a race and go from there, but you can find anything from an 8 week to a 20 week long schedule for anything. You don't even have to race, but if you just follow that, they kind of build in the progression.
Yeah,
that you
I
should
actually
be going
really
at.
Like those. Mm-hmm. I have, and then they if you have them on your phone, but don't look at them while you're running. If you have them on your phone, they'll track with your GPS and they'll kind of tell you how much time you have left. I have those Hal Higdon ones. Like every mile,
I can't do
he's
Hal Higdon.
Like. You only have 3 miles left. Right. And I'm like, thanks, Hal. I used to say that out loud just to like pump myself up if I was doing a long run.
Yeah, I can't. Well, his thing, because he doesn't. We won't get into the minutiae of these things, but real quick, he does not schedule rest days after your long run, and I need that.
He doesn't?
No.
Oh.
At least if you go to his website.
Well, but I don't do, I actually don't. I've never followed it completely because he has like, he says I'm like 3 runs a week and like 1 day of cross training and 1 long run. And I was like, there's no way in the world I would be able to run that much.
Yeah.
So I kind of like pick and choose the way that I do it. Mm-hmm. But I like the encouragement. Like you have 1 mile.
I can't do that. I can't wear headphones. I can't do anything. I can't bring anything with me. So my encouragement is just being angry.
Well, so mine, and you're fast. Like I think some people who are really strong runners, they like just naturally like to run. Whereas I very much am like, I don't like running. I'm very good at staying very still. And so I need like a lot of external motivation to be moving. A recommendation I have if you don't love running and you need some motivation is there's this app called Zombies Run. Have you heard of this?
I have not.
There's this app called Zombies Run. Oh my gosh, you should get it. It is great. And it's a whole bunch of like episodes you download. And you listen to your Pandora or your Spotify or your iTunes while you run. And then stories kind of come in about like how it's like this post-apocalypse and you're a runner from like one of the last bastions of humanity. And basically what you have to do is like run from this camp and then collect like supplies that you need. Like you need batteries, you need gasoline, you need whatever. So you're a person who like literally your whole job is like you run out, you pick up as much stuff as you can find and then you like run back to the camp. And then while you're doing this, they're kind of like radioing you and telling you the story of like what happened before the zombie apocalypse.
Okay.
And then they're telling you, and then they'll also say something like, warning, zombies are right behind you. And then you have to like speed up and that measures your speed.
Oh, it actually tracks you.
And if you don't speed up, and I didn't realize it. Like I thought I was escaping the zombies every time. And then I looked at my app afterwards and I got murdered by zombies like 100 times. But anyway, it's a fun time if you're like me and you really need someone to actually tell you zombies are chasing you in order to run.
Well, that's good. A lot of people say, how do I want to run, but I don't like running. So what should I do? Well, there you go. Download the zombie app.
It's like a fun way to gamify.
And you know they have races like that now too?
Yeah, like, I've heard that. I would just lose so fast.
Yeah.
That it doesn't seem like fun.
Yeah. And I'm not a huge fan of gimmick races either, but.
Oh, I would be. I would be such a fan.
We have completely opposite feelings, I feel like, on running.
I've always wanted to do a color run, like literally just for the Instagram pictures.
Yeah.
And,
See,
and Carl's always like, no, why would you do that? But, you know, that's the other thing I don't understand. The other thing I don't understand about, like, you guys is, like, you would run a 5K in like 25 minutes. I mean, that's not even worth the entry fee. Like, take your time, folks. Oh. 25 minutes, 18 minutes. You guys run a really fast 5K.
Yeah. I did run a Warrior Dash one time, and I did actually choose to participate in an obstacle where there was a big line.
Yeah.
It was all backed up.
Yeah.
Done the final obstacle, and people were hurting themselves. It was crazy.
What, did you get electrocuted?
No, they don't have that.
Oh, okay.
There's a bunch of those now, and again, I'm not a huge fan. But I did do a Warrior Dash one time, and I did choose to do an obstacle instead of going for a good time. So there was that. I would have my one moment of weakness there. But yeah, otherwise, so... so for running, if you're going to the marathon, maybe you'll see Catherine there.
Yeah.
Look out for Carl. He's going to be running.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you know, any questions about injuries or nutrition, basically anything when it comes to running, there's a whole ton of stuff out there
mm-hmm.
on the internet. Just, I would say in terms of nutrition, just, you have to experiment. That's like the thing. You have to experiment on yourself, see how your body reacts. If you're going to do a long run, like a marathon, start trying out gels and goos or whatever.
Right.
Weeks before, during your long runs and practice and see what happens. Anything else you wanted to add about that? Or you want to get to your song now?
Yeah.
All right. So why don't you introduce this one?
The song is called Smoky Taboo by Coco Rosie, and it was on my Spotify Discover Weekly one week, and I really like this song. That's all I know about
it. That's very cool. This is Coco Rosie. That's a song by the band Smoky Taboo.
No,
it's the other way around.
I think it's the other way around.
Okay, sorry. And so we were listening to it on An Unbalanced Breakfast on WMFO Medford 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org.
Thank you.
Welcome back to An Unbalanced Breakfast on WMFO Medford 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org. You just heard the band Coco Rosie with Smoky Taboo. That was Catherine's selection for the week. Mm-hmm. And now she is going to dive into some science.
Yeah, so I'm sure everyone's heard this. I'm not sure everyone's heard of this. To me, it's like, it's everywhere, but I don't think that's the same experience everyone's having. So there was an article that came out this week, and it was published in the British Medical Journal, the BMJ, and it was covered on New York Times Well blog. It was covered by The Salt. It was covered by basically every single article that writes about food has been covering it. And basically the kind of tagline, I guess I would say, of what this study is being billed as is like everything, quote unquote, everything you've ever been told is wrong, end quote. And
that should
be
the title of every study ever.
It really is. Like, it's like you do a study and you think, gosh, how do I make this seem like it's breaking some paradigm? But actually this one is very different. So weirdly, though, so it's getting published, and essentially what they're saying is, like, there was this study done a really long time ago, and the results were buried, and nobody wanted you to know what it was, and so, because it didn't go with our kind of, our preconceived notion of what a diet is good for you and what diet is bad for you. So, back in the day, they were trying to do experimental studies to see whether or not reducing saturated fat and replacing it with polyunsaturated fat in the diet would decrease risk of heart disease and coronary mortality. And so they were doing these really big intervention trials for a pretty long period of time, I would say probably over the course of like 20 or 25 years, where they would take people who usually were in a long-term institution, so some type of hospital, and oftentimes a mental hospital where people wouldn't be in and out, replace their saturated fat with polyunsaturated fat in half of the group, and then kind of see what happened over a really long period of time. There are a bunch of studies done on this, and this study that's being published right now is an example. And this was the Minnesota Coronary Experiment, where in a Minnesota mental health hospital, they had two groups. It was a randomized controlled trial. It was very, very intricately controlled, which is interesting. They put half of the residents on I want to say it's low fat, but it's not really low fat. It was like 40% fat. They put them on a 40% fat diet with almost no saturated fat, with 9% of calories from saturated fat. They took the other half and put them on a 40% diet of fat with 18% saturated fat. You would never get IRB approval to do a study like this now, just because we have seen, you do show that keeping saturated fat that high prevents cholesterol from coming down, and so you wouldn't be allowed to do that now. But basically, they put those two groups on a study on these two different diets, and what they expected to see was that the group with the high amount of polyunsaturated fat, which in this case was primarily linoleic acid, would show a decrease in cholesterol and then would show a corresponding decrease in coronary heart disease and in coronary mortality, so death from heart attacks and strokes and things like that. And they didn't see that. So there was no difference in the two groups. There was no difference. There's seemingly no statistical difference. And so that kind of blew a hole into a really big theory in that it would lower heart disease risk. I mean, and let's let alone the fact that a lot of other studies actually did find a difference and say, like, well, this was a really big trial and it didn't find a difference. And now this data was quote unquote buried. I'm a little confused as to why it was buried, because it was published in 1989. Like, the study got published and in the BMJ, and I was like, Minnesota Coronary, like, presented on this last semester in class. So I guess it was like buried in the world of, if you Google Minnesota Coronary Experiment 1989, the entire paper comes up for free, first result on Google, but I guess, you know.
Would you need to know
there's buried and there's buried.
Would you need to know that you were looking for it? Like, what,
I think
if you're doing general search.
You would need to know that you were looking for it, I think. And I also think that it's not, for whatever reason, it is the first result on Google, but I've definitely had trouble trying to find it in PubMed before. And also, if you look at kind of a list of, here are the seminal studies that have been done on saturated versus unsaturated fat in the diet, it is not usually included. So because the results were null. people don't really include it. So it got published in 1989, but it was a really long time, something like 14 years after the study had been completed, it was published. Now it has been reanalyzed. I'm using air quotes. It's been reanalyzed and republished in the BMJ, and it has made huge, huge news because, I don't know, because it says reevaluation of the traditional diet heart hypothesis. And basically what they found was, I mean, exactly the same. Like, I don't know how to describe. There's no difference between the intervention and the control group.
So now, did they go back and how did they, what's this reevaluation? Did they do a new experiment and they went back to the other experiment
no,
and like
so
recalculated?
They basically found all the data. Okay. I think in an attic, like is kind of the story. Like someone came across the son of the original researcher, found the data, and they were like, hey, let's do this with some more statistical sort of power behind us and see what's going on. So they basically did a bunch of, it looks like just a bunch of Kaplan-Meier curves. So basically they plotted the life, the number of deaths of the control group and the intervention group and did some comparisons. And the major finding that they had was that low cholesterol in the group of people over the age of 65 was associated with a greater risk of death. Or with more deaths rather than higher cholesterol in the group over the age of 65. And so they're kind of calling this entire cholesterol heart thing into question. And I would need to look at, and then they also did sort of a meta-analysis of a bunch of existing studies to see, well, let's re-examine mm-hmm. all of these intervention studies together and see, like, is it favoring the saturated fat, unsaturated fat? Unfortunately, some of the studies that find in favor of unsaturated fat, they deemed for reasons to be inadmissible into the meta-analysis. So when you do a meta-analysis of multiple studies, it's like a study of studies. It's like it's actually literally meta in the mm-hmm. like theatrical. So when you do this study of studies, you have to decide what qualifications you need in order for a study to qualify. And a lot of times when that's with trials, it needs to be randomized, controlled, and double-blinded. And so if that wasn't the case for any of these studies, they weren't including it. So they basically are kind of questioning, you know, we've been really advising people to replace their saturated fat with vegetable oils for a long time, and is that a good idea?
So how many studies did they look at in the meta-analysis?
So the meta-analysis seems to include one... It looks like it's like four. So they did the...
four? They did a meta-analysis of four studies?
Maybe five. Yeah, they did a meta-analysis of five studies. They left out...
Is there a point in doing that with so few studies?
Yeah, because what you're doing is you're pooling the number of individuals who are in the study. So basically what you can essentially do is you have a greater N. So you have a greater sample size. Well, sort of that's what you're doing. So what they kind of do is they have this plot. Now I'm like making arm motions. This isn't helpful.
We need like a simulcast.
Yes. Imagine a vertical up and down line, right? And then they basically almost have like a Venn diagram. Okay. Everybody remembers a Venn diagram. And on one side it says like favors the intervention. So imagine on the right side it says favors the intervention. I'm gonna say it this way. And on the other side it says favors no intervention. And then they basically plot each study on either side. This one says the intervention's better. This one says the control's better. This one
says... The intervention being replacing...
Replacing saturated fat. And then they basically... They do an analysis and then they calculate basically kind of based on an average, for lack of a better term, whether or not the intervention winds up being favored overall or no intervention winds up being favored overall. And in this scenario, they found... it was right in the middle, basically. So the control wasn't favored, but also the diet wasn't favored. There's been a lot of opinions floated around about this. Walter Willett and Frank Hu are epidemiologists at the Harvard School of Public Health, you know, and kind of major, major scientists in the field have just expressed that they don't think that the trial was really long enough because most people were only in the study for a little over a year, whereas some of the longer studies lasted, you know, 6 years, 7 years, 12 years. You know, and then the dean, Mozafarian, kind of said, well, the study was originally designed to look at heart disease outcomes and their major conclusions are based on total mortality. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty big difference, yeah. Especially because, you know...
Cause mortality.
They're looking at all-cause mortality. And so, let me see though if it's all cause or it's and so that's problematic, of course, because the risk of death, right, is like 100%. So in order to control for, like, in order to really be able to see an effect size on mortality, you probably need like a bigger cohort. But you know, it's very interesting, and it brings up a lot of interesting points, I think, about the way science was done 40 or 50 years ago when we're pulling all of these data points from in these experiments that we really couldn't feasibly run today. But you know, I think in general, there's been a lot of kind of skepticism about, well, I don't know if we should, like, because NPR published a story that was like, if this study had been published, all the dietary guidelines would be different. I think people are kind of saying, no, they probably wouldn't have been different. This is one trial. It has limitations like all the other trials. But, you know, it definitely makes sense that we be rethinking about how are these studies run, number one, especially back in the day when maybe some things wouldn't be as controlled. And the second thing is to sort of reconsider, you know, that we're really relying on studies that are much, much older that we couldn't repeat now. But it's very interesting. You can find both papers. I think both papers are available for free, both the old Minnesota coronary experiment and the new study in the BMJ is open access, and it is called Reevaluation of the Traditional Diet Heart Hypothesis. The one other thing I would recommend is that there is an excellent article on Vox that kind of summarizes the entire fat debate throughout the history of the dietary guidelines and experiments. And if you're interested in getting some better context, I would definitely check that out.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Do you have a final, like, expert opinion about from yourself?
I feel, you know, I feel like I feel skeptical that this is proof that saturated fat doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. But I also think, you know, it's definitely worth focusing on. This is okay. I'm going to say what the dean would say. It's definitely worth focusing on eating healthy foods and a healthy food pattern, mm-hmm. more so than worrying about very specific nutrients, if that makes sense. I think that would be what I would take from it.
Yep.
You know, you have a pretty good idea when you look at what you're eating, if it's healthy or not. Focus on whole foods. Focus on that. Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree.
That would be, yeah. Did you have any thoughts?
No, I mean, in general, I mean, not specifically on the study, but I mean, I would kind of concur about that, the obsession with specific ingredients or not ingredients, nutrients,
right.
And kind of this magic bullet.
Right, because too much of anything is going to be bad, mm-hmm. you know, so yeah, think about it that way. But I wouldn't go ahead and start putting melting butter into your coffee. I would not do that. I don't think that this study says it's okay for you to eat unlimited amounts of hard fats. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I don't think that this study says that. Even if the study is like, even if, and I don't think this is true, the study was like, that's it. The heart hypothesis is over. It's done. We've decided it's not a thing anymore. Even if that were the case, that still would not equal the leap to now I can eat unlimited amounts of butter. So right. I would just keep it all in perspective. Michael Pollan has a really good haiku about this. I'm sure we all know what it is. You can Google it. I'm not going to say it.
I was saying that to my friend yesterday, actually. On our way to the show, we were talking about this. And it's like, he's like, well, what? I was like, it's cliche and kind of dumb, but
yeah.
It boils down to that.
Right.
You know?
And try and eat foods, you know, as much as possible, like real food. And that's about it.
Yes.
I would think.
I know. I agree. It's absolutely true. We're going to play our second song of the week. This is actually not my choice. This is a request from our caller from earlier in the show. Sheesh wanted to hear Jump from Van Halen. So we're going to play that now. And then we're going to come back. Yeah, and get to everything that we didn't get to this morning. You have a last chance to call. Number here is 617-627-3800. And you are listening to an Unbalanced Breakfast on WMFO Medford 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org.
Pop quiz. Which is more dangerous, alcohol or marijuana? Study after study, the science shows that alcohol causes much more harm to the user and to society than marijuana. So why do colleges punish students more harshly for getting caught with cannabis? Join Students for Sensible Drug Policy and give your college administrators a simple pharmacology 101 lesson. Visit www.schoolsnotprisons.com to find out if there's a chapter at your school or how to start one.
And welcome back to an Unbalanced Breakfast here on WMFO.
Hello.
You just heard, before the PSA, the song Jump from Van Halen, going out by request to Ashish, our caller from earlier today. And now we, in our last 15 minutes or so here, going to get to all the stories that we have not had time to touch on yet.
Right.
So why don't you go first?
Yeah, I'm going to talk really quickly. There was a great story that came out this week that you should definitely know if you eat food. And that was about, if you've probably heard it, if you've heard the headline, Farm to Fable. Michael Pollan has been tweeting it around, but a reporter at the Tampa Bay Times, did an investigation into all of these local trendy restaurants that claim to be serving farm-to-table food that were getting them, you know, from within a quote-unquote 200-mile radius. And she basically did several months of backtracking to figure out, well, where are they saying they're getting their food from? Where are the suppliers actually getting their food? And basically said, I mean, and it wasn't just like a couple things that are on this menu are not local. It was like, this entire menu is a lie. It's all coming, all the food is coming from other places. So a quick little quote, she said, at Pelagia Trattoria at International Plaza, the Florida blue crab, quote unquote, comes from the Indian Ocean. The death to pretenders is apparently on the menu of the Mermaid
Awesome.
Tavern, but they pretend their cheese curds are homemade, and the shrimp are from Florida, but they are not. And so it's just, I mean, all of the things are just kind of totally made up. And I think that it's because restaurants know that it will bring people in the door. And then also that people aren't going to check. You know, if you tell me, you know, this chicken is from next door, I don't think, well, why, you know, are you lying to me? But it's a really great story. I definitely recommend looking it up. And it was just interesting because a lot of them are really, really brand. A lot of these restaurants, I mean, they really brand themselves on the idea that it's local, it's pastured, it's organic. And so it's, you know, they're branded to get you in the door, but not, they're not so concerned about whatever. Literally, the restaurant Mermaid Tavern has an appetizer called the F-word Monsanto salad. Like, and it's just funny because it's like, okay, that's kind of like, you know, cute. I don't know, cute. I guess that's kind of like, okay, I get it. You're trying to be like so anti-establishment, but you're also like, really? Because, you know, they don't do anything.
So yeah, it's a little extreme.
Yeah. She goes, during Tampa Bay Beer Week, I stopped in to eat. I'm quoting her, by the way, the story. Do you make cheese curds here? Yes, the bartender said. Only it's not. The cheese curds came in a box.
That's a hilarious question to ask the bartender, though, too.
Like, yeah, but people. You would think that the bartender, because everyone on the staff is getting, like, when they get trained, you know, this is what tell people, this is what you... but then she, I don't know how, I mean, you're also just like, I don't know how she figured all this out. It's really amazing. But I definitely recommend checking out that table on TampaBay.com.
And it's not... Definitely not unique to this restaurant or to Tampa Bay. People
right.
who have been around Boston the last several years may remember in 2012, I can remember what date it was yesterday, but back in December of 2012, a big story by the Boston Globe about a bunch of mislabeled fish in Boston. And I know that with Tampa Bay, one of the things is, I forget what fish people thought they were eating, but they're having being served tilapia instead. And that has been going on in Boston. So
that is crazy.
But you can still dig up those stories online that the Globe did, but yeah, very similar stuff going on.
You might know this, Matt, because you're more like agriculture person. But like, so in my mind, I was like, oh, well, maybe this is just a Florida thing because Florida's not a big place for like raising grass-fed beef or like catching shrimp or whatever. But is it something where like, no, in New England, it's just as likely to be happening? Because I thought, I was like, oh, but there's so many farms in New England.
Yeah, I think it's, are you talking about like the mislabeling and making the stuff
up?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the restaurants at the time in Boston were blaming it on the supply chain and the suppliers and kind of not. And it wasn't a drive for, like, obviously they weren't marketing themselves on it being local. So I think that that may have been, that might be a more specific to Tampa Bay in this case.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I don't have a great answer for you.
Yeah. Well, anyway, be aware of whether or not, or try to look around. I mean, it'd be great to see if some Freedman students who are interested did a little, like, investigating into places that, that serve local food here and actually making sure that they do. But in Boston, it's interesting because we even have kind of a trend for, like, for instance, fast food places to have more local produce. I'm thinking specifically of Be Good.
I was just going
to
say,
Be Good, yeah. One of my favorite restaurants.
Traceability is probably the biggest thing. Like,
yeah. But I think they, I mean, and but that's the thing where I'm like, but I know the names of the place where they're mm-hmm. saying they're getting their stuff. So I don't know. I'm inclined to believe Be Good. But that's the thing. I think everybody's inclined to believe the place that they like to go to. So mm-hmm. it's very interesting.
Yes. And
speaking of produce.
Yes. Along those lines, the Environmental Working Group has released their 2016 Dirty Dozen list.
Yes.
Which is, they always rank the.
It's weird that they come out every year. You'd think that once they determine the Dirty Dozen, it would just stay the same.
Well, yeah. I mean, plus, I mean, if you look at it, it's a list of fruits and vegetables that they test and show to be higher in containing, not containing, but being having pesticide residue on them.
Right.
So a lot of the foods end up being foods that you wouldn't take the skin off. So, like, you know.
Apples.
On my head, banana. I don't know if you spray bananas with pesticides, but even so, it wouldn't affect you. It wouldn't be as big of a deal because you're peeling off the skin and eating it. You're not biting right into it. So the number one food on the list this year is strawberries, mm-hmm. followed by apples, nectarines, peaches, and then there's eight more. And quite honestly, I mean, I think the EWG is great, but I think this list is a waste of time. For people who have common sense, because my thing is, yeah, if you're gonna pick an apple and bite into it, you shouldn't be doing that anyway. Like, yeah, it's gonna have pesticides on it, so wash it off. Like, that's the thing that always gets me about this list is that.
So if you just wash the produce off, the trace pesticides come off.
You know, I mean, it's not gonna clear it 100%.
Right.
But I mean, I see people, you know, people in fields or, you know, go apple picking and they're picking things right off the vine and eating them. It's like, well, that's not an intelligent thing to do.
Right.
You should, yeah, wash any produce you get. Like spinach is on here, obviously, because spinach always, well, obviously pesticides is one issue and then concern for listeria and other things like that. And it's because people don't wash their produce or they buy it from the grocery store and it says, well, there's all controversy about, you know, triple wash, pre-washed spinach or whatever. But yeah, just.
Well, but also I think it's important to note that they don't do, like, it's not like people from the EWG go into fields and test the food. They just, they get the test results from the USDA's
pesticide
data program.
Yep.
And so I think it's important also to note that the levels of pesticides, even though they say this has the most pesticides, I mean, it's really hard to, I mean, they rearrange it every year, right? Like, you would think that if there was a standard protocol for pesticide application that they wouldn't be changing the list every year.
Mm-hmm.
But they basically have their own kind of rubric for how they rank it. But I think it's important to note that all of the levels of pesticides on all of these foods are, like, well below the, like, limit, quote unquote, toxic, like an actual limit that would cause, like, an actual effect in a human. So I think it makes sense. It definitely, you know, if you want to buy organic or just wash your be careful to wash your produce because you don't want to make sure that you're eating trace amounts of pesticides, that's fine. But I also think that there's a little bit of kind of adding, like, a scare factor to these things.
That's the thing. And it's another one of those things. It's like you're well-intentioned for, you know, if you're going after if you're bringing attention to the pesticide issue. But people might see this list and be like, I'm never eating these foods again. And then it's like, oh, right, you just cut tomatoes out of people's diets and spinach and all these great foods.
Right. And so. It seems like the level, so basically the way that they determine the level of the maximum amount that it's okay to have is one, that is the maximum amount that's determined by the USDA, right, is 1/100th of the amount that they could give experimental animals and who then had symptoms. And then, and so then the question is how many of the items of produce on the Dirty Dozen meet that allowable amount, and it was none. Mm-hmm. Every single one's below that amount.
Yep.
So, I mean, it's definitely, I mean,
you and then, know, that's then there's the critique of what the level is, though. And
right, there's, and how many, and if their pesticides are interacting and whatever, and I mean, all of those things are for sure real concerns, but I definitely think, yeah, wash your food. You know, buy organic if you want to, but wash your food. Or maybe for ethical reasons. I don't know a lot about the, but yeah, food washing is good.
Yes.
All right. So now we have a quiz, a very important quiz. I get to quiz Matt today. It's very exciting. You may remember that a few weeks ago we talked about a study that came out that compared the sources of protein in insects, in bugs, to the sources of two sources of animal protein. Well, Time Magazine has listened to our podcast. LOL, JK. But they have also looked at the same study, and they have concocted a great little quiz about where calories and protein and saturated fat come from in crickets versus animals. So I'm going to be administering a little quiz to Matt that he will probably embarrass me by getting every single question right amazingly.
I wouldn't bank on that.
But yes, so this is the question from Time Magazine called "Should You Be Eating Bugs Instead of Meat?" by Mandy Oaklander and Lon Tweeden. So, which has more calories, mealworms or chicken?
Is this like on a... I'm assuming there's like average, like per serving
per
or something?
Per serving, per 3.5 ounces.
I'm going to go with the worms because I know chicken is low.
Yeah, remember the mealworms were the ones that were like... super packed,
so gross.
with calories. So the mealworms have 247 calories for 3.5 ounces, whereas chicken is 152. All right, what has more protein, crickets or pork?
Crickets.
It is a tie. So you're kind of
right. It's a tie.
Yeah, you're half right. They both have 20 grams of protein per serving. All right, what has more iron? Honeybee.
Hold on, go back. So is this a certain species of cricket? Or is this a...
Oh my gosh.
You know, because I feel like you could have so many.
Cricket.
Maybe there aren't different. Maybe I made that up. I don't know anything about bugs. I'm not an entomologist, so.
Yeah.
Maybe there aren't any.
I realize that I'm not equipped to answer that question.
Never scratch that question.
Which species of cricket? I don't know. The outside kind. Which has more iron? Honeybee larvae or beef?
Sorry, what was it?
Honeybee larvae?
No, what was the question?
Oh, iron. More iron.
I'm going to go with beef.
It's honeybee larvae. Ew. Which is bee larvae that's scooped out of the honeycomb.
And then you just throw them down? It has
850% more iron than beef by weight. But
so there you go. If you're deficient,
but that's
just
by
find
weight.
The honeycomb.
That's by weight. So I don't know if that's like very light. It seems like you'd have to swallow a lot of it. It says that you'd have to swallow a lot of bee larvae to match even a forkful of meat.
But it doesn't specify? Like how
it
much
doesn't specify how much, but
it's
also
not very helpful.
I just think like 850% more. I mean, you really might be reaching the point of like that might be a little too much iron. Which is fattier, palm weevil or pork?
I don't know what a palm weevil is, but I'm gonna go with that.
Yes, that's correct. They have twice the fat of pork. It's a type of beetle.
Well, thank you.
Which has more saturated fat, silkworms or beef?
Beef.
No, silkworms.
That means it's a correct answer, whatever the sound effect that was.
Yeah.
So it's silkworms?
No, was me revealing the answer.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. All right, finally, one final question, and there are a couple more questions online, so if you want to find out the answers to some other fun questions, check out the quiz. But which has more sodium, Matt, crickets or chicken? Just the general species of crickets.
I may have sounded really dumb. Well, I do that anyway, but that may have been a really dumb question. But it's
no
crickets,
idea.
Right? Didn't we talk about this?
I think so, yes. Most insects are seriously salty.
Yeah.
Crickets had far more sodium than any meat on the list. I'm quoting from that. So crickets are high sodium. So
that's crazy.
Fun note.
So yeah, check out that quiz if you're ever iron deficient out in the wilderness and need to know what bugs to eat.
What bugs to eat.
That'll tell you.
Yes. Hopefully you're near some palm weevils.
Yeah. Just be careful around those honeycombs.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, so that does it for us this week.
Yep.
Stay tuned for Mike on the Mic coming up next. And then next week I will be here, but you will not, right?
Yes, that is correct.
We should have a special co-host, though, and 1 to 2 guests.
Right? Oh,
so
exciting.
But stay tuned for that. We'll reveal. I know I've been behind on updating Facebook this week, but stay tuned for updates this week. And you've been listening to an Unbalanced Breakfast on WMFO Medford 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org. Have a great weekend, and I will see you next week.
Bye.
Make a stew.
A pinch of salt and laughter, too.
A scoop of kids to add the spice.
A dash of love to make it nice, and you've got.
many cooks, too many cooks, too many cooks.